welcome to the Swamp Flicks Lanyap podcast. My name is Boomer.
Hi, I'm Allie.
And I'm Brandon.
And we are three friends in different states who get together once every other week to air grievances and occasionally talk about movies. Some grievances will remain unaired.
Look, you're getting a little heated about Pluto TV.
Yeah, it's true.
And I get it. It sounds terrible.
And this is just my warning to the people of Earth. Pluto TV is the worst app. It does have advertisements just like Tubi, but unlike Tubi, where you might get like three breaks an hour of three commercials. On Pluto TV, I was trying to watch a movie that was 2 hours long. It turned into a 2-hour and 45-minute movie just with the ads, and the app crashed so much that some of those ad breaks, which were six ads long, there were 10 of them, and two of them I had to watch twice. That's
Dear
all.
God.
Oh my God.
At least when we used to watch movies on TV as children without cable, mostly.
Yeah.
You know, they would stretch out a 2-hour movie until like a 3 or 4 hour block sometimes. But at least it wouldn't crash halfway through and you'd have to like watch the commercials over again.
But also you expected it.
Yeah.
You know?
And when we were children, they did not stretch 2-hour movies into 4-hour blocks. They would stretch them into like 3-hour blocks. But I mean, even when they added in like 45 minutes, that was, you know, your time to go to the bathroom, to commune with your family, get a sandwich, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say it was a social affair.
I guess as long as we are airing grievances, I'll go ahead and talk about South by Southwest. I was going to see a lot of movies during South by this year. South by got even more contentious than it usually is vis-a-vis the relationship between the actual like South by organizers and Raytheon, especially at this current point in time. So I mostly attended only ones that were associated with the Austin Film Society because I was going to see those anyway. I did get tickets to see I Saw the TV Glow, and I rode the bus all the way downtown, and I stood in line like a good boy, and they hit capacity among badge holders like 5 minutes after it was too late for me to catch the next bus home. So my request and my message is, please, Paramount Theater, if you know you're going to hit capacity, let my people go so that we can get on our buses home, because I already was hungry. I had been standing outside, and then there were four children on the bus who did not shut their yaps for like 17 or 18 stops. And look, I'm not going to tell a child to be quiet. I think that this current generation of children, they've got it bad enough. But that doesn't mean that I had a good time listening to them talk about Fortnite and girls.
I Saw the TV Glow is having its New Orleans premiere at Overlook Film Fest in a couple weeks.
And will you be in attendance?
I'm going. Maybe I'll be turned away at the door, but I'll be physically going to try.
My hope for you is that you are not turned away.
Or if you are, you can get your bus home.
Yeah. And when I texted you about it, you did point out that that is one that's going to get a wide release. So it's not the end of the world that I didn't get to see it. And in fairness, I did get my money back. And that's that. But however, among the things that did screen at the Austin Film Society cinema that I caught during that happened to be during South by. Don't worry, I won't tell you about the four house shows and the 12 bands that I saw because this is not a music podcast. That will be between me and my journal, and in 50 years, you'll be able to read it at the library in accordance with my will. however, for now, that'll just stay between me and everyone I sent a playlist to of all my favorite bands that I saw. At AFS Cinema, I saw Gasoline Rainbow, which we talked about actually last time because it was 2 weeks ago. But since then, I also saw How to Build a Truth Engine, which is a so-called documentary interviewing various people who are neuroscientists, engineers, computer technicians, or like computer programmers, journalists, etc., about developing a tool that would provide assistance in essentially maintaining the required rigor of journalistic integrity in the face of ongoing online social media misinformation and radicalization. However, I was so utterly displeased by one specific thing that they did not have journalistic rigor or ethics in regards to, that I think the whole thing is untenable. The whole thing ended up being unethical in a way that I could not endorse, and I gave it a 1-star review, which you can currently read on SwampFlix.com.
The most fired up I've seen you since A Glitch in the Matrix.
I was thinking about that while I was writing it, and then whenever you said that to me, you know, you sent me the link when it was published, and you said that it was very, you know, I had sort of a similar screed. And I think it is because I do hold documentaries to a higher, like, level of, I hold it to a certain level of accountability. You know, if a movie is bad, it's just a bad movie. If a movie is bad and its politics are bad and it's going to have, like a far reach, it's still like a bad narrative film. But if something is purporting to be a source of truth, if something is painting itself, and this one very like clearly is painting itself as a source of truth in a metatextual way, in the sense that this is what the film's topic is, it did not meet its own standards of ethics that it stated it had. In addition to just like dick riding the New York Times too much, frankly, for my taste. But yeah, I was fired up about it, and frankly, I still am. Luckily, the next day I saw another pseudo documentary. This one is called Last Things. It is directed, essentially, it is the best version of a student film you could ever see. Like, I say this in the most loving and like positive way possible. It was very student filmy. It's short. It's like 52 minutes, and it's mostly comprised of open source available footage, like from NASA and various like textbooks, old textbook companies that, you know, this is how photosynthesis occurs. This is how chloroplasts are formed. And essentially it tells the story of the Earth from the point of view of rocks, essentially. It's like a geological documentary, but it's also sort of like a sci-fi story.
Just be a rock.
Yeah, kind of. It was based on the director's, you know, feelings about the fact that she was living through the sixth great extinction event on Earth, that we are currently living through it and we know it. And she wanted to take like a larger view of this, like think about the rocks, think about how they've been here forever. She talks about these meteorites that have these metal striations in them. They sort of look like concrete, which is cool. Like, but like concrete almost made of like gems, where the metals in them are metals that were formed as the solar nebula formed into planets. And that these eventually, a lot of them have fallen as meteorites. So we have metals here on Earth that originated elsewhere and which predate the formation of our planet. And that's cool. And it really gets into that. It's a lot of, like I said, open source images, open source video, passages taken from like early sci-fi novels that are in the public domain, and poetry and books about philosophy and textbooks about geology, along with like images from like, you know, Darwin's Origin of Life, and all with this like pulsing, droning electronic music, which is really cool. If you get the chance to see it, I really do recommend this one big time.
Yeah, I do love rocks. Which sounds sarcastic, but I do.
Well, and Brandon texted me. He's like, you know, I admire your restraint to not say that this movie rocks. And I have to admit, I didn't even think about it. And I'm embarrassed.
You should be.
So let me say now.
I'm going to say it. Going to shame you.
Go for it. This movie rocks.
There you go.
We all want what Gene Shalit had, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I also saw one of Brandon's favorite movies of 2023, Bottoms.
Was that on my list? I don't think it was.
I just remember you. I don't know if it was one of your year-end favorites. I just remember you were a big proponent of it.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it in the theater.
It's very fun. I think I texted you almost immediately the things that it reminded me of. Heather's Jawbreaker. And you pointed out Strangers with Candy, which was something I thought about while watching it and then kind of like forgot about afterwards. But it does exist. This movie, Bottoms, if you haven't seen it, it's about two girls who, in order to sort of get out of trouble for not really assaulting like a drama queen football player, pretend that they have started a girls self-defense slash fight club. And then whenever they are called on this, they're like, oh, we can actually use this as leverage to get close to the girls that we are in sapphic love with. I really enjoyed it quite a lot. It exists in sort of this heightened reality of Strangers with Candy, but with like very Heathers-esque sequences. There's even like multiple, you know, bombs that are set at the end, just like JD does in Heathers. I really enjoyed this one. I would give this one a big recommendation as well. Although it also had Pumpkin vibes as well, which is a movie that we've discussed on the podcast before. In the sense that maybe you won't enjoy it if the reality of it is too surreal and too heightened. Once again, in theaters, I also saw Dune Chapter 2, which you can currently read my review of on swampflix.com. I really enjoyed it. A friend of mine ran into one of our mutual friends, and then when I ran into that mutual friend later, they had run into each other at their screening. Our mutual friend was like, I can't believe I was the only one who liked it. I was like, yeah, I don't get it either. Several of my friends thought it was meh. A couple of them thought it was boring. And although I can understand how you could watch this movie and be bored, it couldn't be me. I couldn't be. I was captivated by it. I was, you know, raptured into this movie. I don't even feel like I saw it so much as I experienced it. I texted whenever I sent my review over to you, Brandon. We talked about how you felt like that first one maybe just kind of went past you in the stream. And I do think that maybe the only way that Dune works is you have to see it on the big screen, because if you do, it really will captivate you.
It's harder to get excited to go there. But I'm sure once I was in the room, I'd have, you know, enjoyed the experience.
It's so funny because I had never, like, I hadn't heard any Dune hate until very recently. And then two people that I really like have been like, oh, that was so stupid.
I wouldn't say stupid. I would say it's like uninspired.
Yeah.
Reminded me a lot of a lot of like Batman Begins, in that it's like, oh, we have to correct what's been done to this property and make it serious and logical and like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Correcting it for like the CinemaSins crowd. And I really do feel like Villeneuve is taking over the Nolan spot. Like for the very serious film bro type, like he is the next Nolan. And I just don't find his work that interesting. I have exceptions with both directors. I like Interstellar. I like Arrival.
Interstellar's great. Arrival is also
Arrival
great.
Is great. I'll go out on the limb here and say that I was left very cold by Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah,
I felt
same.
Nothing with regards to that one. Even though people enjoyed it, as someone who liked the original movie a lot, I actually love Ridley Scott.
I think we're all kind of Ridley Scott fans here.
Yeah, I would
even
agree.
If we acknowledge he's like an old man just grumbling at this point, but
yeah,
I'll
grumble. He sure does. But I was left very cold by Blade Runner 2049. And so I can see how, like, the critiques that you're making of Dune, I see those in that one, but I don't see them here. And maybe it's just because, to me, it's too big. Like, this is a big movie. It happens a lot. Like, that was my first thought when I came out. It's like, this movie happened, like, for a long time, and it was very full. I love the visuals in it. I love the story. I really appreciate and hope that there were a lot of people out there who, after the first one, were like, oh man, Paul is really cool, who saw this one and are like, oh, okay, now actually I get it. Like, Paul, this whole thing is a story about how heroism is not to be trusted, which I really enjoy, that it captures that, like, concept from the text. I felt like I was on that sandworm. Like, I don't know. I can't get it out of my head. I still, it's like it changed my brain chemistry a little, almost as much as Madam Web. Also, in the past week, I am currently working on copy for this one, and so I don't want to get too into it and end up repeating myself, but I saw Paul Schrader's 1985 biopic, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters.
Oh, I like that one.
It was a very cool movie.
Yeah.
It was a very cool movie. I'm still not sure if I liked it or not, or if it was good, but it was very cool. Brandon, have you seen this one?
I have not.
Do you know, what do you know about
Yukio Mishima?
Yukio Mishima. Yeah.
Nothing.
Oh, he was a fascist gay novelist from Japan. He's the last person to commit seppuku, ritualistic suicide, in Japan. Fascinating weirdo, but yeah, total fascist.
Are you familiar with the movie or even the title, The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea?
No.
Okay. That's his first novel that I read. It's very accessible. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's weird because his work is very likable, but he was horrible.
he was a strange man. I'm not going to carry water for him. I mean, the man was both a freak and a fascist, but...
Yeah.
So as of when this was made in 1985, and I don't know if this is still the case, he was at the time the most famous Japanese novelist in the West. I think that probably Murakami has usurped that position in like the 40 years since. But essentially he was, so this movie is sort of a biopic in that it tells a little bit about his early life. You know, the fact that he was taken from the rest of his family by his grandmother and kept kind of separate from them until, like, from the time that he was six until he was 11 or so, that he was not allowed to go outside in the sun or play any sports or interact with any other little boys. And then whenever he sort of went back to his, like, immediate family, like his parents, his dad thought that literature was effeminate. So Mishima was already writing in his youth. But his father would like seek out and destroy any bits that he found him writing and beat him for it. So he is very gay. And he is also very fascist. Like, he had a very pro-imperialist vision for Japan. And what's interesting about this movie is that it adapts parts of three different novels of his, specifically with regards to characters that he wrote who kind of represent him or even presage what his ultimate destiny was. So in between like these black and white segments that are his early life, and then these color handheld segments, which represent the day that he died, where he had sort of formed this private nationalist National Guard of, like, I don't know, a few dozen people probably, but he took four of his...
A bunch of,
like,
young men, yeah.
Yeah. He took four of his cadets to this, like, Japanese base, an army base, got in because they all knew him, and he and his, like, people came and trained there at that base. They broke into the office of the general who oversaw it, held him hostage in demand to allow Mishima to address the troops. So they all gathered, and he delivers this speech about essentially his far-right nationalist views and the desire to reinstate the emperor in, you know, the wake of the new constitution following World War II. And all of the soldiers jeer and boo him. None of them are very receptive. Within the movie, he, like, commits seppuku almost immediately afterwards in the general's office. Although I believe that in real life, he actually went home and did it. Although I wouldn't bet money on it. Like, don't hold me to it. So you have this, like, black and white segments that are his early life, these handheld, sort of desaturated a little bit, brownish color segments that depict the day that he died. And then you have these, like, giant, like, expressionistic sets that adapt three of his novels. So there's... or parts of them, rather. So there's the Golden Pavilion, in which the character Mizoguchi represents, like, Mishima's desire to set free this beauty that has been contained, and that represents his, like, relationship with imperialism. There's Osamu from Kyoko's house, who is, like, this man who gets into a sadomasochistic relationship that ultimately kills him, in the same way that, you know, Japan, in Mishima's view, was, like, shackled to this new materialism that came in from the West. And then in the case of Esau from the novel Runaway Horses, he is very much like Mishima in that he tries to plan a coup himself, tries to commit some political assassinations, and then is stopped and ultimately commits seppuku, just like Mishima did like years later. So it's like it was almost like he was writing his own fate. All of the sets and everything that are part of these adaptations are very cool. There's a lot of pink skies and a lot of like very minimalist ideas, you know, like rooms floating in dark voids, but then sometimes the dark voids actually do contain things. It's very cool. I think that you might want to have some Mishima knowledge before going into it. It's not a movie that I would recommend if you're like looking for a scholarly work about him, but no. It is a very interesting, like,
You forgot the Philip Glass soundtrack as well. It is incredible.
That's also true. I already wrote this in the beginning of my review, but as soon as Philip Glass's name appeared on screen, my friend who was watching with us, she was like, oh my God, I knew it was him. He loves arpeggios.
He loves his arpeggios, and it's great.
And then finally, just yesterday, and I am currently working on copy for this, I saw Love Lies Bleeding.
Hell yeah.
Did you see that, Brandon?
Yes, I did.
I fucking loved it. What did you think?
It's fantastic. If I have like one thought about this director, Rose Glass, after seeing St. Maud and this follow-up, it's just like there is something that I usually hate in genre movies that she does so well that I end up coming around and loving it from her, which is like I usually hate in sci-fi and horror films where like all of the supernatural implications are contextualized as like fantasy and dream sequences. It always feels like cowardice. It always feels like you're kind of hedging your bets and like trying to get people to take your movie more seriously. But there's something about the audacious way that she does it that feels like it's just as alienating and strange than if it wasn't contextualized as someone's fantasy.
Did you also see this, Allie? Or did you?
I did see St. Maud, and I loved St. Maud. So, yeah.
Yeah. So the plot of this one, for our listeners, is that Kristen Stewart runs this gym. You know, she works at this gym in 1989, and you can tell that it's the 80s because there are people doing bicep curls and smoking at the same time, which is the coolest thing that you can put onto a movie screen.
Lots of mullets and hot pants.
There are so many mullets and skullets in this movie. So she has a mullet. Her father, who is played by Ed Harris, he has a skullet where it's like he's bald on top and it comes down as this mane. And he is... I have seen Ed Harris play a villain, but I have never been as scared of him.
One of my favorite visual details is that he has the same haircut as his fern.
Yes.
He has this giant fern in his office that looks just like his stupid skullet. It's pretty incredible.
So he runs this gun range, and Kristen Stewart, Lou, is his daughter, and he has another daughter named Bethany, who's played by Jenna Malone. And Bethany is married to a scumbag played by Dave Franco named JJ. And JJ works for Lou Sr., the girl's father, at this gun range. And it is a front for criminal activity. And then a woman who is on her way hitchhiking to this bodybuilding competition in Vegas ends up in this town, which I believe is in Texas. I'm going to say Texas. It was shot in New Mexico, but there's a lot of Lone Star beer being drunk here. Mm. And that says Texas to me, but it's definitely West Texas somewhere because it's all like desert.
It's also a British director setting a movie in America. You know, like the whole country is Texas to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, this bodybuilder and this gym employee, they sort of strike up a relationship pretty quickly. You can't call Jackie the bodybuilder a U-Haul lesbian because she's hitchhiking, but she does move in basically immediately. And through a series of events, she ends up committing this violent act, probably as a result of being given steroids at this gym in West Texas. And then that puts her on this path of like destruction where she ends up being manipulated into maybe committing more crimes. It is very gory. It's very bloody. It's violent. And it is so cool and so good. One of my favorite visual details is there are multiple flashbacks to her being Kristen Stewart. I'm sorry, Lulu. Her being forced to do things for her, like, mafioso father. And they're always framed in this very Coen Brothers-like red taillight. Just like everything is red. It's like it's shot on infrared and a red filter over it almost. That's how red it is. And you see this in these flashbacks where she's forced to do these things. And then like the first time that they speak within like the actual timeline of the movie, they're in the hospital standing next to this Coke machine that's like half bathing them in that same red light.
Yeah.
It's really cool. There are so many wonderful little moving parts in this. Early on in the movie, there's a montage where Kristen Stewart's character is taking all of the egg yolks out of the omelets that she's making for Jackie, the bodybuilder. And then that carries over into like this weird visual metaphor of birth that comes up later. And then also there's a blink and you miss it, like, part of the movie where they're watching TV and the Fleischer Gulliver's Travels is on, which also is important later in a way that I won't get into. But what I will say is that, like, in St. Maud, part of what, like, the joy and the love of it is that the whole time, you know, she's getting St. Maud is getting these, or Maud is getting these visions. She's seeing what she believes are demons. She is, you know, hallucinating perhaps that her the woman under her hospice care is, you know, has a demonic face sometimes whenever she's mean to her. She hears the voice of God coming out of a roach, and it never really lets you know what is real and what is hallucination or what is perhaps supernatural until that very, like, final last moment.
Second. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And it's horrific. And it's like, okay, now it provides context for everything that you've seen. There are things in this movie, and this is what Brandon was talking about, where they do seem to be visions more than they are supposed to be realistic things that are happening to this character, but it leaves it up to you to decide. And I really appreciated that.
I don't think it does. I think it trains you to understand that you are seeing the world through this character's eyes so that by the end it can go off the rails without losing you. And from what I can tell, a lot of people think this movie, like, loses its way in the final act. I think it's really fun and, like, over the top and, like, in a perfect way. But I think that it does a lot of groundwork to get there, where it's like, you have to understand that this character's muscles aren't growing in real time every time they take a steroid shot. Like, that's just how they feel.
Right, right.
And then, you know, once it gets you used to that rhythm, then it's allowed to, like, take that visual motif even further.
Okay. Yeah, I accept that as a valid interpretation and probably the correct one. But I really loved it, and it sounds like you really loved it.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. It reminded me a lot of I'm certainly not the first person to make this comparison, but it reminded me a lot of Bound. And there just aren't a lot of movies that hit that exact, like, lesbian neo-noir note. Like, it's a very rare specimen.
Yeah, it's also got some real Thelma and Louise vibes too.
Yeah.
Because sticking together is what good waffles do. Brandon, what else have you been watching?
I watched one of the worst and one of the best movies of all time. I guess I'm only bringing them up because they're, like, on either extremes of that scale. But Brittany was getting rid of some DVDs that she was going to take to the thrift store if nobody wanted them. And I picked Theodore Rex out of her pile. Because it feels like I should have seen that by now.
Yeah, I haven't seen it by now either, but I always am intrigued by it. So you're about to tell me don't watch it.
I've always had a morbid curiosity of my own, where it's like people do say it's one of the worst movies, but people say that about a lot of things. Like,
exactly.
I'm curious about Heaven's Gate, you know?
There was something kind of comforting about watching it and being reassured that, yes, movies can be very bad. Like, I'm so used to, like, watching something like the Super Mario Brothers movie or, like, Batman and Robin and being like, oh, people just don't know how to have fun. This is actually, like,
yeah, really exactly. Goofy. People don't know.
No, Theodore Rex is actually bad. If you don't know, this is the movie where Whoopi Goldberg plays a cop in the future who is assigned a partner who is a Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's an animatronic suit with blinking eyes and little moving T-Rex arms. So basically what happened was Whoopi agreed to be in this movie in like a verbal contract. And then once she realized like the production level of it, that it wasn't going to be like Jurassic Park, that it was going to be something much smaller, she tried to back out. And then a lawsuit resulted in a judge ordering her to be in the movie for $7 million.
Oh my God.
She is barely a screen presence in this. Like, she is, it's like a legal obligation for her to be on camera.
Literally.
So a lot of the like faults you'll see when people like talk about this movie is like, oh, you know, Whoopi Goldberg sleepwalking through this. What a shame she didn't like turn on the charm, you know? And I think that's like true, but not really the main thing that sucks about this. What really sucks is the dinosaur has no personality either. Like, it's just like a deeply uncool, nerdy, anxious dinosaur. It's just not fun to hang around with. I would be so disappointed if I was like a child and had seen this. That like, well, first of all, not only is like the dinosaur a drip, but also they're investigating the murder of another T-Rex. So you have to look at the corpse of another T-Rex through.
Oh no.
And then on top of that, the dinosaur investigating that death is also terrible to be around. Just like not fun. I'm so used to like championing these movies that are like so bad they're good, but I would be surprised if anybody's ever stood up for this one in those terms. It's got some fun production design marks to it and some like surprisingly committed performances from Carol Kane and Bud Cort.
You're not gonna get those two to not commit.
Yeah,
right, they are in it.
So it kind of sounds like they're also like, it sounds like they're like playing off of like Roger Rabbit and
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
There's just nothing you would get out of this movie that you wouldn't get out of Super Mario Brothers, the live-action one, or out of, like, the Dinosaurs TV sitcom. Like, those have you covered. Like, don't look to Theodore Rex to fill in any blanks for you. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, I watched Brief Encounter for the first time.
Oh, I love that movie. It makes me cry, but I love it. I don't know anything
about it.
It's directed by David Lean, who the last time we talked about him, we talked about Summertime, which is like a 50s movie he made with.
Okay.
This is 1945. It's about a brief affair. It's about these two married people who meet each other on this train platform. Their trains are going in opposite directions, but they meet in this like city once a week. The male is a doctor who's like practicing at this like hospital once a week, and the woman is doing her like weekly shopping in like the town next to hers. And after they run into each other on the platform a couple times, then they start like hanging out together on purpose. They start going to like restaurants and movie theaters and like end up like having these kind of romantic dates in this sort of liminal space between their actual lives. And what's really fascinating about it is that it's shot like a noir. Like, it's shot like this crime film that they're, like, getting away with something. But all the crimes are, like, moral ones, you know? It's, like, they're cheating emotionally. They're having this, like, emotional affair. But everything's shot as if they had, like, were covering up a murder or something like that.
But also, I feel like by the end, you're, like, I don't blame them.
What do you mean?
Because, like, by the end, like, you see, like, how miserable her marriage is.
I don't agree with that at all.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. You think her marriage is miserable?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very 1940s marriage, so it's miserable to me, but yeah.
No, I think it's like they are excited by that like rush of emotions from when you like start something new with somebody, and then they go home to their domestic routines with their spouses. It's very like settled and sweet, but not exciting, you know? And she's confessing in her mind to her husband this affair that she's been having, because he's the one person in the world that she trusts. And she's like, well, I can't actually tell this to you because it would ruin our marriage, but you're the only person I'm going to allow myself to be vulnerable to. So kind of in noir fashion, like a lot of noirs are structured with that flashback thing where you like confess your crimes in retrospect. She's doing that to her husband full length. And at the end of the movie, the husband's like, he's like, I don't know where you've been mentally, but thank you for coming back to me. I thought that was a very sweet moment. It hit me emotionally because it's not condemning her for having an emotional affair, but it is saying something about long-term monogamy and the fact that like there are ebbs and flows to it. And sometimes you are distracted and like pulled away from the person that you've committed your life to, but like that doesn't mean that you failed at it. It's just like, sometimes you're in sync and sometimes you're not.
Yeah.
So I didn't think their marriage was like bad. I just thought it was realistic.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's just like a very beautiful movie. And I've heard people call it the most romantic movie of all times. I think that's fair. I think it's accurate. But I actually would put the sort of like, thank you for coming back to me line at the end in the same league as like the rush of flirtation. You know, like it's romantic and it's acknowledgement of like domestic partnership as well as indulging in like the rush of cheating. Which for a 40s movie, it's crazy that like if this was made in America, one of them would have been hit by a train or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like they would have punished for their crimes. But yeah, it's very beautiful. Lots of steam coming off the trains as they pass on the platforms. So it's got this kind of like smoky atmosphere to it. And it is thrilling, like a crime film. Like like the first time they have like an inside joke, you're like, what are you doing? You're risking it all. Yeah, it's like a thriller where nothing actually thrilling happens, but your heart is in your throat the whole time.
So it's sort of like a romantic Queen of Earth, where Queen of Earth is like a slasher film where all of the violence is emotional.
I kind of get that. Yeah, like Queen of Earth is shot like a horror movie, even though like nothing on screen is as violent as like the trailer would make you believe.
Right. And this one is like a romance movie where the intimacy is sort of not quite there, but it's shot like a crime movie with no crime, where the crime is emotional.
Yeah, it's like it's an emotional affair that's shot like a heist picture.
Okay. All right.
And it's just very beautifully done. Have you watched anything recently, Allie?
Yeah, I have, actually. So I was saying this off mic, but my husband broke his humerus. It's not funny, actually. And yeah, so we had a couple of days where we embraced the curative powers of Danny DeVito. So we watched together Throw Mama from the Train.
I've never seen it, but I've always wanted to. I'm very intrigued by it.
Funny.
But whenever we're trying to figure out a movie to watch, no one's ever like, yeah, we agree. We will watch this with you.
So Danny DeVito plays this like kind of downtrodden, like mama's boy to this very abusive woman who's the most grating, like horrible woman on the planet. Like just, yeah, she's always like very talking down on him, like hitting him over the head, you know, that sort of lady. And he's been taking a writing class, and his writing teacher is Billy Crystal, who has an ex-wife who stole his book idea, published it, and is now like a superstar. His ex-wife, played by one of our favorite captains on one of our favorite franchises.
Would that happen to be Kate Mulgrew?
It would happen to be Kate Mulgrew.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
now she's more intrigued than ever.
I know, you should be. And yeah, through a series of miscommunications, Danny DeVito's character thinks that they have a plot to kill each other's like mutual like problem ladies, basically. And so, yeah, so Danny DeVito is like, I killed your wife. Now it's time to do the swip swap, you know, kill my mom. And so he gets this idea from the movie Strangers on a Train.
Right, okay.
By the way. And yeah, so we get to see all of these failed murder attempts on Danny DeVito's mom. And like what should be kind of like a little bit of like a misogynistic, like sexist thing. I don't think it, like, I think the fact that the mama character is so terrible really kind of gets it out of that territory.
How does she rank on a scale of like 1 to Tati Danielle?
I have not seen Tati Danielle. Brandon, you've seen Tati Danielle, and probably this movie.
I was thinking of Tony Soprano's mom because that's what I'm currently watching.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm never not imagining her, so.
I was actually trying to remember, was this the lady from the Goonies?
Yes. Yes. Okay. She plays the mom before. In the Goonies. Yes.
Yeah. She sucks.
She's the worst. So it's a very funny movie, and it's one that I hadn't seen since I was a kid, and you know, there's just these moments that like it's like core memory unlocked. Like, oh yeah. So yeah, we watched that one. It was very fun. Then we of course had to go on to watch Twins, which I really enjoyed it. I thought it is a lot better than, because, like, I don't think, it's another one that I had not seen since I was a kid. So, for those who don't know the plot of Twins, there's a eugenics-type experiment to make the perfect, like, man. And, like, instead of just making one person, we get twins of, Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and we're led to believe that Danny DeVito got all of the leftover like scrap parts, and Arnold got all the good bits, basically. And Arnold goes to find his like lost brother, and it's like a movie of them together bonding because Danny DeVito's character is like a very Danny DeVito, like, charismatic scumbag sort of character.
That's the Danny DeVito special.
It is. It really is. So, yeah, I just thought, like, this movie was better than I expected. I enjoyed it.
I like that one a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a fun movie. I mean, I know, Brandon, you're a big fan of Arnie, and I also am. So
he's got great comedic chops.
He really does.
I think we've established this before that we all do because I love Kindergarten Cop. I love it.
Yeah, it's like I'm a big fan of the Terminator franchise. I'm a big Kindergarten Cop fan. Actually, filmed in Oregon. So young, Leo. And yeah, I don't know. This one is just so good and so fun. And I like texted my sister and I was like, if we don't try and recreate the outfits from Twins, what are we even doing as very close siblings? Like, what is our life? So I've got grand plans for if my sister and I go out on a night in the town, just matching outfits.
Very strangely, they also had like a Twins reunion at the Oscars this year.
They did. It was so good.
I'm not sure why that happened, but it was definitely adorable.
Yeah, I loved it. Of course, you know, they comedically framed it as a Batman villains reunion, but that was good too.
Which made absolutely no sense.
It's so that they could cut to Michael Keaton in the audience a couple of weeks before the announcement of the Beetlejuice sequel. Just for synergy.
So then, finally, I ended up for the first time watching Wise Guys. Have y'all seen this one?
Nope.
I don't think so.
Okay, it's a Brian De Palma, first off, which I did not know.
Already interested.
It's got Joe Piscopo and Danny DeVito, and they're like lackeys for the mob. And like they get in way over their heads when betting on a horse for the mob boss and end up being hunted down. And they're just like dingus wackies, you know, like once again, kind of a charismatic scumbag character, but also, you know, not as cool and as badass as he thinks he is sort of guy in like a very like charming, bumbling way. And it is a very funny movie.
I don't know that I would expect a Brian De Palma comedy to be good. It's surprising to hear.
I was going to say, I know a lot of people like think it's kind of a dumb bad movie, but I enjoyed it. It kind of fits my sense of humor very well, which, you know, take that with a grain of salt. But I thought it was a lot of fun. It's got some very like cartoonish like moments and like kind of a weird sort of that era like 80s comedy surrealism that those movies have, where you're like not quite sure what universe this is taking place in. where it just kind of bends reality just a little bit, which is always fun in those movies, I think. Like, I feel like comedies are kind of embracing that sort of, like, what universe is this even in bit a little bit.
Bottom certainly did.
I'm into it. So yeah, that's what I've been watching, embracing the curative powers of Danny DeVito, as we all should.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Alive, surging up from the depths of the sea on a tidal wave of terror to wreak vengeance on mankind.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters. It's alive.
A gigantic beast.
Stalking the earth, crushing all before it.
In a cyclonic cavalcade of electrifying horror.
Raging through the streets on a rampage of total destruction.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Incredible titan of terror.
Wiping out a city of 6 million in a holocaust of flame.
Jet flames cannot destroy it.
Bombs cannot kill it.
All modern weapons fail.
Is this the end of our civilization?
Godzilla turned 70 years old this year.
Happy birthday!
A lumbering dinosaur we all love very much. We're very glad to have him in our lives. For twice the length of our lives.
Or three times for some of us.
Sure. One of the ways that that birthday was commemorated was that a Japanese movie studio made Godzilla Minus One last year, which was like this throwback to the 1950s film. And it was set like right after World War II and really played with the kind of tones and tropes of the original. And that movie won an Oscar for Best Special Effects. And was the very first time a Godzilla movie was nominated for an Oscar, very much won one. And you cannot watch it at all right now because Toho and whatever American studio owns the Godzilla rights right now have this like non-compete clause where because the American studio has Godzilla versus Kong coming out this week, there cannot be a Japanese Godzilla movie on the market. I don't know if that was originally started with like, presuming it would be like a mockbuster, like people would get the two movies confused, but there's just like no way that you would mistake Godzilla Minus One for Godzilla X Kong. Like there's just like no way those two movies would be like the same to you.
No, absolutely not.
Believe it or not, things used to be worse though. In 1954, the original Godzilla movie did not get distribution in America immediately. It came out here 2 years later in 1956, retitled Godzilla King of the Monsters. And they shot new scenes for that film with actor Raymond Burr, an American actor.
Yeah.
Inserted into the plot. He was like at the periphery of the events of the original Godzilla movie and commenting on it, giving basically white Americans an in to finding the story interesting.
Yes. It's
like relatable.
So that is, I think, if, you know, that version carried over to the VHS copy. I'm pretty sure that's the version I saw first as a kid.
Of course it was. It was for me as well, because the original Godzilla in its Japanese version was not available in America until the 2000s.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Things used to be much worse.
The 2006 DVD, which is the one that I got from the library for this, was the first release of it in the States.
That's crazy. I finally cashed in. I don't know if y'all know this, but like if you subscribe to the Criterion channel, they give you these like credits every now and then.
Yeah.
That you can cash in at the store. And I finally cashed in all my Criterion credits on buying the Godzilla box set that they put out.
Oh, I had no idea. That is cool.
It is very
That's
cool.
A very smart move.
And I've been kind of intimidated to crack into it. And this week was like a good illustration of why I've been intimidated, because you know we're watching the original 1954 Godzilla. I put that disc in and I ended up watching it, and then watching the American edit with Raymond Burr, and then watching the commentary track for both of those movies. So I've seen Godzilla four times this week in four different versions.
Wow.
God bless you.
And
Godzilla bless you.
It is like a dense text, even though like as far as like the humans on the ground emotions go in most of these kaiju films, I don't think it's much better than most of them. Like the actual characters don't really hit you that hard. It's more about the communal terror of this creature who's awoken by hydrogen bomb testing off the coast of Japan, attacking cities like Tokyo. But the real world context of America testing in the Bikini Atoll and poisoning people with nuclear fallout, and then, you know, also obviously Nagasaki and Hiroshima with the atom bomb before that, and what's going on in this movie on like a communal level, where the devastation of the monster, showing the sideways pans of just like the destruction after Godzilla leaves the frame, were like really haunting for me in this movie. Like, just like dialogue and music free shots of just devastation, and like thinking about how soon this was after the war and how there were still continual tests of like even bigger bombs after that happened. That all hits really hard. There's even an Oppenheimer style figure in the movie who's creating an even worse weapon and feels conflicted about using it to stop Godzilla, because what if it falls in the wrong hands?
And arguably uses it in the only like ethical way possible.
Yes, he takes himself out with it so that no one can use his science for evil. And I don't know, I think there's something
Oppenheimer.
dense about this, like culturally and historically and politically. And I would, you would think that the American remake would be kind of like a cheapening of all that and like a flattening of it. But honestly, it's not bad. Like, I grew up watching that version as well, Allie. And I thought it would be like embarrassing to return to it. And it's honestly like a really good creature feature, that sort of like Roger Corman style rubber suited monster movie. It's still a really good version of that. Like,
I was going to say, it's still good.
Yeah. But there's something a little more elegant and sad and haunting about the Japanese original. And I think that kind of fits to what Godzilla can be in both senses. Like, ever since this original movie, Godzilla has gotten much sillier and like for children. Previously, we talked about my favorite movie in the series, which is Godzilla vs. Hedorah. And that one's really goofy and over the top and high style and flashy and cartoony. This original movie isn't that. It's like black and white, scratchy film, because the way that they had to handle the prints when doing all these like matte matchups, even in the 50s, it would have been scratched up. So it already has this like antiqued look to it. And there's just these gorgeous images, especially when Godzilla is like backlit by fire.
Oh my God. I was about to say, like, oh, that's like my favorite just shot in that movie is Godzilla backlit by fire, like, and destruction just looming over Tokyo. It's like, too much.
But yeah, the movie can be both kind of like throwaway sci-fi novelty art. And I think the American version really brings that to light. Like, it is kind of like the midnight movie that like horror hosts used to like host on like local television broadcasts. But it also is like genuinely emotionally affecting art and beautiful. All of the large scale destruction effectively achieved in miniature is really beautiful artistry. And the more you sit with like the devastation of this community living with the fallout of nuclear war represented by this literal monster. Yeah. It's very like haunting and devastating at the same time that it could be brushed off as something goofy. I think this movie is like one of the best movies ever made. I don't know.
This was amazing.
I love this movie. This movie is like a staple of my childhood. So I grew up like partially living with my grandparents, and my grandpa was like obsessed with all big monster movies just generally. So yeah, this was like a staple of my childhood, to the point where my little cousin, like all Godzilla movies, my little cousin used to call Rodan Big Bird. Like, it was not the Sesame Street character, it was Rodan, the giant kaiju monster that would fight Godzilla. So this is one of my favorite movies ever. The American version and like this one. So yeah, I definitely agree. I love it so much.
Was this a first time watch for you, Boomer?
So I have also seen the American version with Raymond Burr. It wasn't as frequent a feature in my childhood as it sounds like it was for y'all, but I definitely remember there was a period of time right after we had just gotten, you know, access to Sci-Fi Channel that they would show a Godzilla movie like every weekend. And so I was young enough that they kind of all run together in my mind, but I do remember lots of bits of this one from the Raymond Burr American version that came out in 56. So it was not a first time watch, but it was a first time watch in this format and the first time in a very long time.
One of the insights from the commentary track that I didn't really consider was that, like, it used to be considered kind of respectful to do a dub instead of a sub for a movie, which is the exact opposite how we think of it now. Like, now it's like insulting and disgraceful that someone would like Americanize this movie. But like at the time, you know, dubbing and like recontextualizing stuff costs more money than just throwing subtitles on it. So they thought the movie actually had like more commercial potential outside of Japan, and like people would be interested in it. So like the fact that they invested in it to do the Raymond Burr edit was like a show of faith that the movie was like worthwhile to export, which is really the exact opposite of how I think of that movie from modern perspective.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of modern dubs aren't as lovingly made. Like when they're lovingly made, like a Studio Ghibli movie, like it makes sense. Like you do feel like the craftsmanship of it, and you know, like you get great, ridiculous, unhinged, like Robert Pattinson, like voice acting, like roles. Like, but I think that is the exception and not the rule. And I would say that is part of why a lot of people think of these as disrespectful now, is they don't necessarily always put in the effort for them.
And I will say the American version of this movie does not change fundamentally what the movie's about either.
Right. It's still about the horror of the atomic age. And it does grapple still with like our national history.
And that's what like all atomic age sci-fi is, really. I mean, the same year that Godzilla came out in Japan, we also had that movie Them in America, which was about giant ants.
Giant ants.
Yeah.
They kind of end on the same line, like, oh, we've thwarted these creatures today, but if nuclear testing continues, who knows what will haunt us next. So, yeah, I think the world was ready to grapple with this stuff. There's just something almost documentary about this movie in particular. Like the crowds running from Godzilla, the devastated landscapes. It feels almost too real, like newsreel footage or something.
There are people in this movie who flee in terror on a street and then are reduced to atoms.
Ooh.
Like it's horrifying, actually.
It is.
There's some really great rear screen projection work happening where there are people, you see Godzilla behind this building and there are people in the windows screaming, beating against the glass, terrified for their lives. It's a lot. It's very heavy.
I think it doesn't make it any better that I have been listening to the audiobook Ghost of the Tsunami about the 2011 like tsunami in Japan with the Fukushima disaster and all of that. I'm just like, oh, maybe this was the wrong time to read this and then watch Godzilla. Or maybe it's the perfect time.
Should we, I mean, this movie is 70 years old. I guess, should we do like a brief plot summary?
I don't know that that's entirely necessary.
Okay.
I mean, we've already kind of said, like, Godzilla came up from nuclear testing, destroys Tokyo, and then an Oppenheimer-type scientist has a weapon that is worse. And
uses
it to destroy Godzilla, or at least this Godzilla.
The film, at least, wants us to care more about this love triangle that we have not mentioned.
Oh yeah, there's a love triangle.
I don't think that matters all that much.
I disagree, actually. I think that this movie would be lacking something without it. I know that it is just like a typical, you know, 1950s thing. Oh, there's got to be a love triangle because, you know, we have to have, you know, something that sells like this romance. But I actually do think that there is something really important about the fact that this like romance is blossoming under this threat. that there is sort of this interaction between the old and the new, in the sense that the Oppenheimer figure is in like an engagement, perhaps even an arranged marriage, to the daughter of this other scientist who I don't think we've mentioned yet, Dr. I think his name is Yanabe, who is the only one who seems to understand that like Godzilla's threat against humanity is not out of any kind of malice. It's simply because man fucked with what he shouldn't have fucked with and has released this prehistoric creature, which they peg at 2 million years old. I'm not sure if that's actually what they thought at the time or if it's just like a math error. His daughter is in this like arranged marriage, perhaps, to this Oppenheimer figure. And yet she falls in love with someone else. And the doctor, professor character seems to be completely okay with it because the guy is basically living in his house at that point.
He's married to his oxygen destroyer, really.
I mean, that's true.
That's the Oppenheimer guy. I think the doctor, like Yamanabe, like, he's married to his research as well. Like, does he even realize that this guy's been living with them? Like, or is this just some dude at his house?
I mean, maybe. You could be right.
But yes, our Oppenheimer figure is also very much just married to his research. And, like, she obviously cares for him as well.
Yeah, she doesn't want to break his heart. And whenever she goes to tell him and he shows her this oxygen destroyer thing that he's created, she's like, oh, actually, maybe this isn't a good time.
You seem like you're dealing with some things.
You know what I will say about Godzilla Minus One is that, like, that one actually does maybe make me care more about the people individually than even this movie does. Because when I see that love triangle, I just think, oh, those are sweet kids.
Yeah.
But, like, they're kind of part of this larger tapestry where, like, the community is the character and not any individual person. So it's hard to track what they're doing from scene to scene because they're kind of part of this larger crowd. And, like, I get just as much emotion from, like, an unnamed character crouching, protecting her three children from destruction above.
Oh my God. No.
I guess, you know, to me, there is something happening narratively about the hydrogen weapons dividing time into the time before and the time after. And so we have the sort of traditional thing that's happening with the Oppenheimer and his betrothed and, you know, something sort of modern happening where his betrothed has fallen in love with another man. But we also see like two ways in which people try to appease Godzilla, which is that, you know, within the context of this narrative, Godzilla is just this name that's been given to like seasonal lack of fish. Like, you know, clearly these people, they perform these, they talk about doing rituals to appease Godzilla during times where there has been no fish. There have been no fish and it's affected the village and its ability to eat. And so they talk about how in the old days we used to sacrifice a maiden and now we just do these dances.
A very King Kong moment, honestly.
Yeah.
It was pulled right out of King Kong.
It feels like it's got to be an homage to it. You know, it has been like, what, 20 years since then.
About, yeah.
And this movie is very clearly inspired in many ways by King Kong as well. Not just that, but also like
as
with the planes. Yeah. But we're seeing what they are trying to do, this very traditional, old school, religious, spiritual way of appeasing a spirit whose name they have now applied to this prehistoric monster that has emerged in the present day. And how that is also ineffectual, and they have to tackle a modern problem with a modern solution. So I don't know. There's something about those two things and various other things that seem to divide time between before and after, in the same way that we often divide time and before and after the bomb. That's happening here as well.
Yeah, I appreciate them as like more symbolic than like that. I'm involved in their emotional lives, I guess.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about the plot, though, like structurally, what I find really funny watching this, you know, 70 years later after it was made is like the mystery of what's causing the destruction. It's pretty like, I don't know. the first couple scenes or sequences are of these like fishing boats going out and not coming back.
And there's a lot of really, really great like nuclear weapon imagery in those scenes too, like the flash of light and like things just like, yeah, just being fucking destroyed.
And that was referencing an event from 1954 where a man died 6 months after being exposed to radiation from a hydrogen bomb test that the U.S. was practicing off the coast of Japan. Basically, like a fisherman crew was not aware that the test was happening, and they got too close to the blast. And that was like a fresh news story when this movie came out. But after that happens, then there's an attack, like the first Godzilla attack on this village, where people who survived the fishermen expeditions are then crushed at home. So it's almost like this nuclear fallout thing where it's like, even if you survive the blast, you can still be killed later from the radiation poisoning or from being crushed by this giant lizard, depending on the perspective. And that attack is shot like a mystery. Like, you don't know what's causing the havoc. It's just like the roof is collapsing in on people. The walls are shaking. And there's just something really funny about hiding Godzilla in those early scenes. Like, what is it? I can't tell what's committing all this chaos. And then finally, I think like about a third of the way in the movie, you see the monster peeking out over a mountaintop. You don't see his whole body, like just his head. And then it feels like the final 40 minutes to an hour are just nonstop destruction, where you get to see so much Godzilla just like fully on display, which is an interesting structure because like for us now, like it's not a mystery what Godzilla looks like anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a perfectly normal, acceptable, and even standard way to structure like a monster movie.
Yeah. Creature feature.
Where it, as a creature feature, you don't see it for the first half hour. You only see its effects. You build it up in your mind, then it's revealed, it goes on its rampage, and then at the end, humanity prevails, ? But you're right that because, you know, Godzilla is such a huge part of pop culture, it would be like, you know, trying to disguise, like, Superman or Batman.
Right.
Or, you know, what your movie is about. It does seem ridiculous, like, in hindsight, that we don't just get straight to Godzilla.
I mean, the movie does satisfy you once Godzilla's in full glorious display, though. Like,
oh, that's
the mixture of like puppetry and the wearable costume and the stop motion and the matte paintings. And like, it just really is like an all out spectacle. I think it was like the most expensive Japanese production at the time.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And you can feel that care in the visual art, like every little building and train car and power line, like everything is like very meticulously detailed as it's being stomped into dust by the creature.
Yeah. One of my favorite images even comes from that early part where they're still sort of keeping him hidden, which is the footprints on the beach.
Yeah.
Yes.
And like the wide swaths of his tail. Like, I'm like, oh, you really get a sense of scale from that I think is really, it's very effective.
And that was done as a matte painting as well. So like there's the like beach water and the tree line and all that is like an actual photograph. And then they did a matte painting of just the footprints in the sand.
Amazing.
That's a special effects shot as well.
Amazing. I'm impressed by how much Godzilla lore is already present. Like the atomic breath and the like light up, like antenna, like designs of his back scales.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like that sort of, if you were to watch a modern Godzilla movie, you would think that's something that was added to the lore later as they like made him cooler, you know, not to use another comic book example, but like how in the 1930s, Superman was introduced in the comics with very few powers. And then by like the 70s, he had like super ventriloquism and super weaving and everything.
Yeah.
Like you kind of assume that these like, you know, things about Godzilla came later, but no, they're there just from day one, really.
Even now, like, I'm going to go see the new American Godzilla movie just because it doesn't look particularly great, but Godzilla's pink now. You know, they added a new detail.
Godzilla's pink now, and I gotta go. Cool.
Yeah.
Did we as a group see and enjoy Shin Godzilla 10 years ago?
I loved Shin Godzilla.
I agree. That one I also think was very good. And even that lore, that like sometimes the worst villain in a Godzilla movie is bureaucracy. Even that was present here.
Yes.
You know, they have these meetings where they're like, should we tell anyone anything about what's happening? Will that cause a panic? And, you know, you have some of these legislators who are like, yeah, we absolutely obviously need to tell people that there's a giant monster. And then the other half of this like legislative body that's like, oh, I don't know. We can't let the beach be closed on the 4th of July.
Well, was that debate, because no one ever says the word America in this movie, but was that debate like we can't acknowledge what's happening because that will seem accusatory to America?
Oh.
Who we are beholden to right now, yeah.
Or even, we can't let this become public knowledge because who knows what the fuck the Americans will do to try and stop this.
Well, there's another one,
And how much fallout, literally and figuratively, Japan will suffer as a result.
It did feel like there was something going unsaid in those meetings.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It's just, you know, this movie just sets like... like, we can talk about, you know, the King Kong influence and all that, but, like, it feels like this movie really does kind of just set the mold for any other, like, monsters that may follow it. It's a high mark to follow. And the fact that they're still making Godzilla movies, you know, what other franchise are, you know, we still making that people are so fascinated with that they're going to flock to the theater to see a foreign movie, just because I know it like sold. It did really well at the box office, Godzilla Minus One.
It did better in America than it did in Japan, which is
interesting.
I think it is the longest running film franchise, period, Godzilla.
I mean, like, not in years, right? Because if you're talking about franchises, Kong was 20 years before this, but probably not as many films.
Yeah, I mean, Godzilla never stopped. There's like constantly Godzilla movies in production.
Okay, I accept that definition. Then.
We've had a few King Kong movies, but they're pretty well spaced out.
Yeah, we get one about as often as we get A Star Is Born. I guess that's true.
Yeah.
Until recently.
Yeah, because Godzilla's carrying him across the finish line.
I will once again say that I thought Kong Skull Island was much better than it had any right to be.
I kind of liked Godzilla versus Kong, the one that came out during the pandemic. I thought it had like really good pro wrestling style smash 'em ups. It felt like people smashing action figures together in a play box, but like that's fine. Godzilla can be that too.
I haven't seen any of the Kong movies because I was just kind of like, I don't know. They look kind of dumb.
They are kind of dumb, but Godzilla can be dumb.
Godzilla can be dumb.
There are a lot of really fun Godzilla movies that are basically just pro wrestling in rubber costumes. And those movies have their place.
They do.
That's my like kind of go-to when I don't know what to watch. I'll just throw on something like that in the background. It always pleases me. It always works. But this movie in particular, and maybe Shin Godzilla and Godzilla Minus One as well, have like this extra layer of like thoughtfulness to them. It's not just smash 'em ups.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I almost want to throw Hedorah in there as well, just because it's so wonderfully art directed, but it is a silly movie.
It gets back to Godzilla's roots insofar as it is about like pollution. Something with life altering consequences for everyone.
Yeah.
Where the monster is once again, you know, humanity and what we've done to the planet and each other. Even if it is like, you know, Godzilla flies around on his farts or something in that one, it's still great.
And there are tons that I haven't seen in the series yet. Like, there are dozens and dozens of movies.
I was going to say, there's so
many discs
many.
Are left in your box set.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that I'll never watch them all because I'll just get lost in the special features for every disc. Well, I have to assume that we will talk about Godzilla once again at some point. If nothing else, I need to get through this box set, so I might rope y'all into some more of these. But do we have any more final thoughts
on
this particular one before we move on?
Like I was saying, like reading this book about the tsunami disaster and then some of this imagery and, you know, the way it captures what a disaster looks like, and the scope and the horror is just so impressive. I don't know. I don't know if there's any, like, as many disaster movies as there are out there, like, I don't know if there's any that really capture, like, that sort of terror as well as this, honestly. Like you were saying, that scene with the mom, like, sheltering with her kids is, like, haunting.
Those pan shots of, like, the desolated landscape.
Yes.
Just as impressive as any of the special effects shots.
Yeah.
Oh, Godzilla does so much damage in this movie. So many people died. So many. And even in moments where you're like, you know, the people I was watching it with very early on, we were like, oh no, Godzilla destroyed that some kid's toy helicopter. You know, like, the miniatures, they're not very well disguised. And that doesn't matter. They're still, like, very impressive with a lot of what they've done. And the cities, the miniatures of cities that Godzilla destroys, it's heartbreaking to watch. It really and truly is. Even though there's, like, a distance that you have from it because it does kind of look very toy-like at times, it's still devastating.
I do think there's, like, a kind of, like, invitation to dream with those miniatures.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, maybe they don't look real, and that you're not going to mistake a toy train for a real train.
Right.
But you are sort of, like, submitting yourself to the fantasy. You're, like, suspending your disbelief and, like, living in that world.
Well, I also think there's, like, I know it's unintentional, but there's also this feeling of, like, yeah, we're small in the face of something this big.
We are but toys to this monster.
Exactly.
Having trouble trying to sleep. I'm counting shit but running out. As time ticks by, still I try. No rest for cross tops in my mind.